isn't it pretty? All right, shall I go? Okay, I'm good to go.
Welcome to our three-part series on APM Corporate Partner, the National Trust, where we'll be finding out how the charity has brought project management close to its organisational heart. I'm Emma DeVita and I'm your host. I'll be delving behind the scenes of the National Trust, visiting Deerham Park, a 17th century mansion near Bath, which recently underwent a multi-million pound transformation project, and a community garden in Dagenham, East London. Across the three episodes, I'll be meeting project professionals, from the head of project and programme management through to apprentices who are part of the 400-strong project management team at the charity. They work on a huge range of projects, from historic house transformations to tech implementations. I'll be finding out just how important the professionalisation of project management is to the success of the National Trust, and how the support it receives from APM as a corporate partner has helped create a motivated team of successful project professionals who are climbing the ladder of APM qualifications with the goal of achieving chartered status. In episode 1, I meet Mike Hudson, Head of Strategic Planning, Projects and Programme Management for the National Trust, and Senior Project Manager Tim Camborne, who takes me on a tour of Deerham Park, where he led a huge transformation project. In episode 2, I meet Joe Dimitri, a Senior Programme Manager who works on the National Trust's Urban Green Spaces projects, and Project Officer Emma King, who gives me a guided tour of its community garden in Dagenham. I also speak to Dean On, another chartered project manager who is closely involved with the National Trust's ambitious net zero strategy, a critical part of its future direction. Finally, in episode 3, I meet three apprentices at Deerham Park, Rebecca Corcoran, Flora Smith and Maddie Hills, who work across the National Trust and have been inspired and supported to expect the highest standards from themselves and the charity they work in. Welcome to episode 1 of our series about the National Trust. I've just arrived at Deerham Park, a 17th century house and garden near Bath, which recently underwent a £3.2 million transformation project. As I walk up the gravel path, I'm faced with a honey-coloured Baroque house that was built by William Blathwaite in the late 17th century. Blathwaite was secretary to Wars of King William III and was one of the most influential ministers, civil servants and colonialists of the late 17th century. Over the centuries, the house underwent remodelling, drastic redecoration and eventual disrepair before passing into the National Trust's hands in 1961. In late 2015, the go-ahead was given to the wholesale re-presentation of the house with the aim of recreating the interiors of the turn of the 18th century, when William Blathwaite was at the peak of his career. The house then was filled with luxury goods and furnishings from around the world. The project was a complex one to manage, and later I'll be meeting Tim Camborne, the senior project manager who led the work on the house and gardens, which included structural repairs, conservation and redecoration that have led to dramatic changes to restore the interiors to its original beauty. Tim is going to give me a behind-the-scenes tour of some of the beautiful restoration projects from within the house. So this is the Great Hall.
Yes, so this is the kind of core of the medieval house that stood on the site before the present house was built. And we've still got archaeologically underneath kind of these floors, we've got the cellars that actually show the layout of some of that original house.
Wow.
And then each of the wings on the, or the fronts on the, I don't know, east and west, mixed up on the east and west, they were the bits that Blathwaite built in the 1690s.
So can you describe what we're looking at in here? It's pretty sumptuous and glorious with two chandeliers as well.
It does, it looks amazing now. It didn't look quite as good a couple of years ago. So just as a kind of background, a lot of feedback we had from visitors was the fact that the house looked a bit unloved and more shabby than chic. So the project was to basically redecorate and represent the interiors. So this room, you've got kind of panelling up to kind of a third height of the space, It's a mixture of oak and softwood, but then it was originally grained, which means it's painted to look like a particular timber, in this case oak. Before the Trust owned it, back in the 1920s, it was all painted white, or kind of broken white, and this original scheme was lost. So we did analysis of the paint layers, and then found the original scheme. So there's a panel in one corner of the room, which we cleaned back to, and then the rest of the room has been redecorated to match that. So it now looks like the original 1690s oak graining.
Yeah, and you've got all these portraits of the family.
Yeah, and that was the other thing we did as part of the scheme is this room's also been rehung with painting. So now you've got, as you say, you've got all the portraits of the family. And you've also got King William. And Queen Mary. So they were key because they had when the Glorious Revolution happened in the 1690s, William Blathwayt, who had the house built, he was basically kind of head of the civil service for the king, also Secretary of War. So he was his kind of right-hand man, so that's why you get the King and Queen's portraits in the house. And it's also why William had massive influence, and so the east side of the house was designed by the King's architect because he had those kind of contacts.
And the chandeliers, are these
original? Yeah, the other thing, like I say, the other things in here that we've done is you've got the three large oil paintings on the ceiling. And all the ceiling was redecorated and all the kind of gold lining around those frames was redone. And then the two chandeliers, which are two crystal chandeliers, they've been out of the house for about, well, not out of the house, but not hung for about 10, so a bit over 10 years.
Yeah.
And so they've been taken apart piece by piece, rebuilt, rehung, and then electrified. So all the lighting is LED. Candles. And to give you an idea, I think it took something in the order of 5 months to do this room.
Wow. So you must have been dealing with many different kind of partners and stakeholders for
yeah.
this.
Yeah, so obviously it's a Grade 1 listed building, so lots of consultation with Historic England, the local authorities, conservation officer. So we're kind of going through all these rooms as you kind of develop the plans and kind of consulting all the time through that. We also had a really good relationship with the village, so you know, things like the parish council and people like that. So we try to always share what we're going to do. Although kind of the work inside the house, to a large degree, the village probably don't mind that much. They don't really have a big view on, but they're interested in things that might affect visitor numbers and that kind of thing, so it's always good to keep them involved. And they're very supportive, and we have quite a lot of volunteers as well who kind of help
really
kind of man the house, and they live in the village as well.
Okay, do you want to take me to the gilt leather parlour?
Yep.
Or the old stairs, I don't know which is closer.
We'll go through this way.
We'll go back to Tim's tour later, but first let's meet Mike Hudson, Head of Strategic Planning, Projects and Programme Management at the National Trust, for his overview of the work that the 400-strong team of project professionals at Charity do. We met in one of the private rooms at Dereham that had been given over to the National Trust office space, complete with hidden doors in the wood panelling and a tiny spiral staircase. Mike has turned his back on a career in accountancy to join the charity to do some good in the world, as he explained. 15 years later, he oversees more than 8,000 projects a year with a budget of around £300 million.
So 15 years ago when you joined the National Trust, what role did project management have then? Was project management kind of embedded in the organisation?
No, not at all. And to be honest, I didn't know that's what I'd end up doing.
Oh, when you took the role, you didn't know this?
No, so it was a specific project working with staff and volunteers to improve volunteering opportunities at this particular property.
Oh.
And it was only from there that I ended up working on an organisational change programme in around 2010. And kind of put myself forward to do that and ended up working on that. And through that, one of the management processes we identified that we really needed to improve on was project management, because we have no standard approach in the organisation. As was part of a change programme, I led the kind of work stream to look into project management as part of the wider change programme. All those kind of proposals were accepted. And then the role for, as it was called then, head of project support was advertised, which I went for and kind of got. And the task of that role was to embed into the organisation a project management framework.
Were you working with APM then already? Did you have any support?
At that point, not with APM at that point. We did have some consultants that came in who, they were the ones who kind of devised the, I suppose, the bare bones of the framework.
Yeah.
Relatively kind of standardised way. And then we were the ones who kind of essentially branded it and sold it into the organisation. Mm. And at the same time we did that, set up a very small, what was called a project support office, essentially just me and one other person when we first started.
Yeah.
And recruited, at that point in time, we had two people whose role title was project manager in the organisation. We've now got over 400 in the profession.
That's huge.
Yeah, and we recruited I think there was about eight or nine senior project managers. They were going to, they were assigned to our most complex projects. Mm. So we kind of got a bit of a grip of those. But at the same time, part of their role then, and it still is today, is to kind of act as sort of internal ambassadors for the profession and really champion what we do and the professionalism from there. So that's kind of where it all started. I mean, we've come a very long way since then. And I moved on from that role to a different role. And there was another team who kind of then took it on even further. And then I came back into an expanded role at the beginning of 2021.
So why don't you tell me now actually about what your current role and responsibilities involve?
It's a ridiculously long job title.
I've had longer.
It's head of strategic planning and project and program management. So as it says on the tin, I'm accountable for our strategic planning processes. So how we translate our strategy into delivery, whether that be through our business as usual kind of operations, or whether through kind of change and through projects. So that's part of my role.
Mm.
And in some ways, I kind of think my job and my team's job is really about helping the organisation deliver some brilliant things.
Yeah.
You know, creating the processes, the environment, the capability to do that.
Mm.
So, yeah, so the strategic planning is part of my job. Then I've got the capability development is another part. So that's project management, programme management. And we've had a huge push recently around sponsorship because that was a bit of a gap for us. And we have, I mean, this is where we work really closely with the APM in terms of all the different training programs. We've got apprenticeship program, various different kind of program management interventions, but also then different levels of the kind of project management. So really we're focused on the grades below project manager.
Mm.
We kind of go for the project management qualification
mm-hmm.
for those grades. Then the project managers, we're encouraging, yeah, if they haven't got the PMQ, let's definitely get that. But then let's go towards the kind of project professional qualification. And then our seniors and others are going for the kind of chartership so that we really kind of up the get. And that's really collectively upped our game. So and we've introduced better approaches and minimum standards to our recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm all for if we've got an existing member of staff who's not quite got the qualification. Well, I've been there, so I get that. But it's, you know, how do we help that person, you know, get that qualification? And it's not just about the qualification. It's about the kind of shared language. It's about access to the latest thinking. And it just constantly keeps moving the profession forward. In terms of the project management office, which is a kind of key team within my wider team, over the past three years or so, kind of effectively had to rebuild that team because of the impacts of the impacts the pandemic had on the organisation.
How big an impact did that have on the team?
Across the project managers, across the profession, we lost over half of our profession. So I think we were down below 200 staff at one point.
Yeah,
that's huge. We had to stop so many projects because of the issues relating to cash flow. We're now back up to over around 400. But for many reasons, we kind of lost a number of people in the profession. And from a kind of central project management office point of view, we essentially started again. But the great thing that that has enabled is there was myself and one other person, and we've now kind of grown that team. I think there's still only about 5 or 6 people in it, but it's a kind of, you know, it's the kind of enterprise level project management office.
Mm.
And we've, I suppose, drawing on the National Trust's approach to things, we've been able to curate the team in terms of what the sort of skills we need, where they've come from, a real kind of diverse mix of people who now work in the team, which has just added so much to what we do, what we're known for internally. We get a lot of internal kind of plaudits from people. They've spent a lot of time really kind of synthesizing down the advice and guidance, so it's kind of as crisp as it can possibly be. And we've got a continuous improvement plan that just rolls through in terms of various different areas that gets improved. And one of the key things we've done is we've set up kind of like a stakeholder, what we call a stakeholder service. Essentially, it's like relationship managers internally that point to the directorates and the regions. So we can kind of agree, because it's a small team, small kind of expert team. There's only so much they can do. So we agree with a kind of order of priority of what, so we're not getting swamped with work, which is, and that sounds like a small thing, but that's just made a massive impact. And we other people prioritise the work in a way, so they've got a real stake in it as well.
Yeah.
We've set up an assurance service for our really major projects, which is making a big difference.
Mm.
And so I think our reporting has, we're in the early stages of introducing a PPM tool. That's in some ways forced us to do a lot of work on the kind of process and the kind of the base data before a kind of tool comes in. So the reporting that the team do has kind of massively improved, dramatically improved.
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you about, you know, what advantages or benefits has the increased professionalisation of project management within the National Trust actually brought?
We are now a project management organisation, and we weren't when we started this. So people really appreciate the value that project management brings and the value that really excellent project managers can bring. And even the language, so even when we first started, you know, we talk about business cases and gates and risk management and sponsors, and it's like a new language for people. They didn't really get it. And now it's a common language that's common outside of project managers and outside of the profession. It's just a common language in the organisation, which I think has made a kind of a real difference.
Where is the National Trust now, and what are your ambitions for the future in terms of professionalising it?
I would say it's probably halfway between the middle and the kind of world-class end.
Yeah.
So we've certainly not got there yet. Again, one of the kind of very conscious pieces of internal branding that I did was the team I run, we refer to as the Centre of Excellence for Planning Projects and Programmes.
Yeah.
We deliberately chose that wording, not because it's a destination we've reached, but it's a kind of journey that we're on.
Yeah.
Why would we aspire to do that? Well, we're Europe's largest conservation charity. We've got more members than the people living in Norway.
What?
So we've got nearly 6 million members, and we should be the best at what we do. So we should be the best at delivering those sorts of projects because we're entrusted with these charitable funds. And the scale that we are, the impact we can have, why wouldn't we aspire for that?
Mm.
It's not good enough to kind of put up with second best, in my view. So that's what I kind of push us forward for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see that there's different strands of that professionalisation. I wanted to ask you about the National Trust's relationship with APM as a corporate partner. So what benefits has that brought?
It's provided a kind of helpful frame, as in across industry, this is what good looks like. That's why I also sit on the corporate advisory group for APM. And through that, meeting a whole range of people from across different industries. And it's always fascinating to talk to kind of counterparts in different organisations, because a lot of the time we share very similar problems. I remember sitting next to somebody from Rolls-Royce, and it was the first time he attended one of these, and we got kind of chatting, and I said to him, what are the big things you're working on at the moment? And he said, what about you? And half of them overlapped, and he was slightly sort of, I can't believe I'm working at Rolls-Royce, and we're designing aircraft engines, and you're at the National Trust, but we have such similar challenges. And I said, well, that's what's fascinating about this, in that, and some of the challenges that they're further ahead on, we can learn from them, but others we're further ahead on, and they can kind of learn from us. So, and I think, again, you know, people internally, they enjoy being part of a kind of a thriving profession that really supports their personal development.
How much more successful are your projects now that you've brought in this professionalisation?
We certainly have less high profile. What's that go wrong? Put it that way. I think the thing we've really focused on recently is making sure things are set up well from the start. And I suppose in some ways the kind of clarity of our overall planning of our overall portfolio has got a lot better. So, for example, for many years, every year, we would say we would deliver a certain volume of projects, and we measured it by, you know, how much money we would spend. And every year we would under deliver by 10-15% against that number. And in the past couple of years, we've created a new problem. We've started to over-deliver.
What? So, that's a nice problem to have.
Yeah, well, it is in some ways, but you do have to fund those projects. So So we've really flipped that dynamic.
Yeah.
And we've also got a lot more efficient as well as we've done that. So the crude sort of measure, but if you measure the number of project professionals and or the kind of wages associated with project professionals and how many, the volume of projects that get delivered, that has definitely improved over the last, you know, decade as a metric.
At the moment, we're in Deering Park, and listeners probably would think, when they think of the National Trust, they think of historic houses like this.
Yeah.
But I know within this series, we'll be speaking to other people who work on very different types of projects. So right now, how would you categorise the different projects in the National Trust, and how might that change over the kind of near-term future, medium-term future?
We have the ones, as you articulated, the ones that we're associated with, you know, the kind of country houses and the conservation of those, the restoring of those, sometimes just the ongoing maintenance of those. You know, quite often they might need a new roof, which tends to cost quite a lot of money. We've then got visitor infrastructure type projects.
Yes.
So car parks, food and beverage, retail, and all the associated infrastructure that goes with that. We then have what we call land and nature projects. So this could be the restoration of landscapes. We tend to do that increasingly at scale with partners. So we may own part of a landscape. So let's say part of a valley. You may have other landowners within the valley. So we're increasingly trying to work at that sort of scale to, you know, restore nature. Another kind of domain of projects we have is working in more urban environments in partnership with people, because a lot of time we don't own land or houses there, but we can bring some level of expertise to kind of work with others to try and bring access to green space much closer to people. And then we also have other sorts of projects, like, you know, we have lots of IT projects, we have business transformation type projects, we do a lot of marketing, so those, you know, those sorts of things. I mean, one of the biggest ones that we've done recently is an upgrade to our CRM system.
Yes.
And as I was saying before, given we've got 6 million members, that was a really significant undertaking.
Over your time here and the experience that you've now got under your belt, is there a particular National Trust approach to projects and programmes that you would characterise?
One of the things we have learned, I would say, again, over the past decade, is we're quite a geographically dispersed organisation, and we're quite a delegated organisation. So one of the challenges that brings is that we quite often do the same sort of project multiple times in multiple locations. And what we used to do was do that with multiple project managers, probably doing it for the first time, again and again and again.
Yeah.
And we're moving to a more kind of pluralistic approach to delivery. So we still have individual projects that are delivered.
Yeah.
But we have certain types of projects where we have essentially like a portfolio team who go around delivering that project multiple times. Yeah. So one of the things I used to do was I used to run our renewable energy program.
Yeah.
So we have a brilliant team of people who go around installing biomass boilers, ground source heat pumps, micro hydro, and they've done it so many times now, they've got really good at it. I think that's, there's that kind of, it's a bit of a, it can be a bit of a trap, you know, because the core thing about project management is, oh, this is a unique endeavour, and you know, that's why you need project management. But if you sort of, my view, if you overdo that message, you get yourself into a mindset of, well, I can't possibly learn from anybody because this is the most unique thing that anybody's ever done.
Yeah.
And I think that's really unhelpful.
Yeah.
So it's kind of trying to tread that middle ground of going, there will be elements of this that are unique, but there's also going to be elements that probably somewhere else has done before. So what can I learn from those people? They might have done the same project, but they may have had a similar stakeholder challenge, or they may have had a similar approach to contracting, or whatever it happens to be. So I think there's things you can kind of learn from.
If you were talking to someone in your position from another organisation or another sector, what are the really kind of hard-won lessons you've learned that you'd wish you'd known that you could then pass on to them? So, you know, what we've just been talking about is one thing. Is there anything else that you have seen to be something that has become critical to the future success of projects that you'd pass on?
It's the level of engagement that you need to undertake to make sure, give things the greatest chance of being successful. Is the way, I always use language like that.
Yeah.
You can't guarantee things are going to be successful because the world is a complex place. But it's what are the things we're doing to give ourselves the greatest chance to be successful? And you can't do that on your own, either as an individual in an organisation or as an organisation, actually. So that's why I say increasingly we're working in partnership with others. So I think the time and the effort that you devote to that communication, to that genuine engagement, really pays back. And I think when I was younger, I probably didn't appreciate that as much as I now do.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's relationships, is it? Relationship building as much as anything else?
It is. It is about relationship building. It's also about, is there any part of the project that you're working on with others? As in that you're, it's a joint endeavour.
Yeah.
And is it genuinely a joint endeavour? Or are you just paying lip service to it? We're doing some consultation, but are you really going to listen? Because people know, they can see through it. So it's got to be really genuine. And one of the things I talk to people about internally is that there's also a really strong link between to that and how success is defined on a project, because that kind of slightly esoteric question of, well, how do we know when we're successful? And a lot of the time it's because it's about what others think. Do they think this thing is successful?
So how do you measure success on National Trust projects?
One of the things we talk about is you've got the traditional measures of, you know, you've got your time, cost, quality, that sort of thing, the iron triangles, we refer to it. But actually, that really only takes you so far. And a lot of the things we do, that gets us to a certain point of delivery. But you can have something that finished on time, cost what it said, and to the quality that you'd originally decided, and people go, that's fine, but I don't like it. and is that successful? So the sort of added ingredient then is around, it's about taking those people with you. You know, well, how would they define success? So take Durham.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Durham. How have you measured success?
So the people that use it, the visitors, the members, do they think what we've done here is a good thing?
Yeah.
Because you need both, I think, to be successful. It's got to, you know, time, cost, quality, but it's also got to be, increasingly we think about the kind of beneficiaries and, you know, what kind of level of public benefit is being delivered. Now, we are defining how we measure that going forward. So don't ask me about that at the moment, because we can do another episode about that.
But it's a work in progress, right? And trying to understand how you should do these things. And like you said, it seems to be a learning organisation. So it's not ever taking anything for granted or thinking that, yes, you've nailed it. It's just carrying on redefining. Yeah. Thank you so much for giving me such a great insight into what you do in the work at National Trust and giving me that kind of vital overview. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now back to Tim's tour of Deerham Park, where he takes me to the gilt leather parlour, which is roped off to the public and the last room to be restored, and then shows me to the beautiful old stairs that underwent painstaking renovation work.
So what room is this?
So this is the gilt leather parlour.
But there's no gilt leather in it.
Conspicuous by its lack of gilt leather, yeah. So the scheme you see here is the wallpaper, which is a kind of goldy flock wallpaper. And I think the idea when it happened was to give the feeling of the kind of opulence of a gilt leather.
Mm.
And again in here, all this panelling was all painted white in the 20s. So again, we've gone back to the grain schemes. Again, this is all painted. And then each panel has got quite a figurative representation, I guess. Yeah. So that's to look like burr walnut.
Yes, I was going to say that it's like burr walnut.
Yeah. So what we're doing at the moment, this is kind of the last room to be completed, is we are going to rehang this room with panels, but they will be, they'll look like gilt leather, but probably not in leather. Mm-hmm. So we're looking to make them. We've had samples done of a man-made alternative, which is a kind of a plant-based product.
Why is that?
Because of kind of 21st century kind of views of using leather, and the animals that are used for this kind of installation, they're only bred for their leather. It's not a byproduct of...
Oh, how interesting then.
Having a steak kind of thing. So it's we weren't kind of comfortable that was the right way to go.
Okay, I think we've got a few minutes if we go to the old stairs.
Yep. This is the old stairs. So it's a three-flight walnut staircase.
Shipped from Virginia.
From Virginia,
in 1690s.
So if you think of the kind of the millionaires of today who will do whatever with their kind of properties to almost show off their wealth, this is the equivalent of the 17th century.
Mm.
Because William had the connections with Virginia, he could get this timber sent across. And when you come round as a visitor, you know, as one of his guests, you're not going to have that, because no one else has got access to it. Yeah. So you can kind of say, oh, look at my walnut staircase. So so that's why this is important. And again, this room was painted white. So all this was white, which I don't think there's a photograph of now. And this has all been, in this room, has been stripped. So the staircase itself is actually walnut, whereas the panels are all softwood, and they've been... grained. So it's the usual combination of solid
tell.
Timber and graining.
You could not tell, could you?
No.
And with a project like this, imagine there's one thing restoring or reinterpreting the decoration, but structurally, when you came to start on the project...
Yeah, so this staircase was propped up with acro props.
Right.
So the second flight, as it kind of turns, there was a lot of movement in the staircase, and we were only allowing two people on the staircase at any one time.
Wow.
But we stripped off all the panelling underneath the soffits of the flights, and then I've put a combination of timber and timber repairs and steel cleat reinforcements to stiffen the staircase. But now it's kind of fine
safe,
again.
Yeah.
But the amount of time it took to strip the white paint off of this, you can imagine, was...
All by hand.
Tim and I leave the main house and go behind stairs to the National Trust office, where he tells me all about the management of the Dereham House transformation project. Tim is a senior project manager in the National Trust Southwest region and is responsible for Dereham Park and Prior Park. He joined the charity 33 years ago as a building surveyor before morphing into a project manager.
Well, so we're sitting here in what is your office, I've just discovered, at Dereham Park, which is definitely has not been renovated.
No.
And it's exciting as someone who's not in the National Trust to actually get to see behind the scenes.
And, over the ropes.
Yeah, over the ropes. Can you tell me all about the project here? So when you started working on it, what the scope of the project was, what you hoped to achieve, and a flavour of what it was like to lead a project like this?
This project started off as
an interpretation or reinterpretation project. So it's going to be about installations in the house and some redecoration.
So when was this?
This was back in 20, oh gosh, before me, so about 2016. And then for various reasons, it was kind of recognised that it was more complicated than that. Then I joined the project, kind of as the overall senior project manager. I feel like I got a bad habit of joining a project, and then my first thing is I tell people that the budget's not big enough and the programme's not realistic, which is kind of what I did here. So we went from, at that stage, it's going to be something like, I'll probably get the numbers wrong, but something in the order of 1.8 million. And it went up to 3.2 million. But not in a kind of unplanned way, as in a, right, okay, so to deliver what you want, the realistic budget for this is 3.2 million. So we went back and fundraised and kind of made that funding available.
So straight away you were getting a realistic budget together?
Yes.
And how successful?
And a realistic programme as well.
And how successful has the project been in meeting those?
We're still on budget or within budget.
Wow.
So
okay.
That's good.
Yeah.
But the programme, we're kind of on our revised programme, which may sound odd, but obviously, well, there's two things. One is we lost probably a good nine months during COVID for various, well, for reasons everyone knows. And then more recently, we've got one room to complete the gilt leather parlour. And to get that gilt leather or the a facsimile of it made, it's taken a lot of time to test alternatives, get all the colour schemes right and all that kind of stuff. So that is the kind of thing hanging at the end. So that's going to be completed at the end of this year. But everything else went
fantastic. Can you talk us through the different stages of the project and perhaps what the biggest challenges were?
Yeah, so we deliberately broke the project down into phases. Because there was a big fundraising element, I was keen that we did something as an exemplar. So the old stairs, which had been painted white in the 20s and had to be stripped back and repaired and structural repairs to them, about 320,000 from memory. I wanted to do that as a standalone piece so that we could show potential funders the quality of the work we're going to do. And then we kind of carried on in phases from there. So we then did the exhibition space, which is converting what was formerly a staff flat and offices into a introduction. There's two films in there plus objects that you can handle to explain the kind of background to the house and William Blathwaite had it built. And then in the house, we did the house in with one contractor but in two phases, because again we were trying to keep as much of the house open as possible.
Yeah,
there was a stage we did close over one winter for about 10 weeks, where it just became impossible to get the logistics to work, to get people in and the contractor. So but apart from that, we stayed open all the way through.
One of the questions I had for you was to ask you around the increasing professionalisation of project management here since you joined, I guess. So what benefits has that brought to you? And I mean, I imagine part of that is having a professional team of project managers.
Yeah, I mean, I think historically project managers were kind of, they had that as a title, but actually probably weren't.
Yeah.
And it got tacked onto their day job, and we were quite good at setting people up to fail, if I'm honest. So the fact we've got that kind of professional structure is really good. It gives a really clear pathway for PMs to work up inside the trust. It also makes it really clear where people stand. It makes it much clearer about capability and things as well. So when you're looking to allocate projects to a project manager or a project manager to a project, you have some easily measured kind of things that you can see through qualification or whatever. So when project management started to become more professionalised, I guess, from 2011, sorry, and starting along that kind of journey, it was very difficult. You kind of did we brought in like assessments for how complex projects were, so we could allocate the appropriate people. But it was quite difficult still to judge the appropriate people, if you like. I mean, you knew some people and thought, okay, they can do it, but having something tangible, I guess.
An objective.
Yeah, and you could, yes, exactly. So it's much better, I think, it's better for the individual as well. Mm. I think we have in the past just given people stuff they weren't, we kind of overfaced them with a project.
Yeah, so not quite ready for it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's important you kind of match projects and people.
Do you mentor any apprentices or other project professionals?
Yes and yes. So I mentor an apprentice who works with me, or here on my other project, who is coming to the end of her apprenticeship in whatever that is, about 10 weeks time, I think. It's a bit scary. And it's been really good, and hopefully, well, she'll get the qualification out of it, but also hopefully she's had a really good experience as well. And then, yes, I mentor other project managers. So I think at the moment about 4, I think.
Hmm. How long have you been chartered, and what has that meant?
Ooh, that's
for you?
A good question. When did I do that? 22? I was thinking it was last year, but no, wasn't it? The year before. Yeah, it was 22.
What did you gain from that process?
It was really worthwhile. And I think a colleague of mine who was doing it at the same time, we both said it was just because you were, and this is going to sound bad, I suppose, but forced almost. You had to kind of go through all that information about how to manage projects and all the stuff about processes and all those kind of things. That, and when you go back through it, you realise, actually, I'm not doing that as well as I could be.
Mm.
And then other things, okay, yeah, I'm all right with that. But you do kind of identify, maybe not gaps, but to much as, I guess, kind of with experience, you end up not taking things for granted, but maybe not giving things as much time as they should get. So I think that was really, really worthwhile, actually. Mm.
Coming back to the work that was happening here at Deerham Park, as you go along with a project like this, what approach do you take? Are you there assuming that there will be nasty surprises along the way? What kind of, or good things that get discovered? I mean, what kind of mindset approach do you take?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably with these kind of buildings particularly, you're going to find something you don't want to find.
What was the case here?
Here wasn't too bad. There was one interesting piece, another staircase, where it was kind of, the floor was depressed under the newel post, which is the thing that kind of sits in the corner of the staircase. And we investigated underneath, opened up an old vault that had been blocked up in the 50s, and then realised there was absolutely nothing underneath that at all. There was a marble slab, a rotten floorboard, and thin air.
Gosh.
And we did that thing, it was me, the structural engineer, and the architect, and we kept measuring and measuring and measuring because we couldn't believe this thing was just balanced in the middle of nothing.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Yeah, so those sort of things are quite interesting.
Yeah. Any happy discoveries?
In the, what, the closed silk bedroom, which is at the kind of east, southwest corner of the house. So we had to take the wallpaper and the canvas lining off because it was it had been water damaged in the past. And we took it off, we found remnants of the original 17th century panelling. And then, obviously in the past, it had been partly dismantled, but also lots of graffiti on the wall and stuff. So it's just really interesting to kind of stand where someone stood 200 years ago, doing their little basic sketch of a horse or whatever it was, or writing a little message. It was just that I just find fascinating.
Yeah.
From 200-year-old graffiti to the trials and tribulations of a modern historic transformation project, my thanks to Tim for his fascinating behind-the-scenes explanation of what it takes to pull something like this off, and the benefits that a professionalised project management team brings. This episode, I've learnt not only about how central a professionalised project management function is to the running of the National Trust, but also the success in projects this brings. It's also been fascinating to understand what it means to work on a historic property like Deerham Park, in the joy of discovering its hidden secrets. In episode 2, I'll be meeting two project professionals at the National Trust who are working in very different areas of the charity, renewable energy and urban programmes, plus a tour in East London of a community garden that has recently opened up to the public. Thanks again to Mike and Tim, and to you for listening. As ever, we want to hear your comments, feedback and suggestions at apmpodcast@thinkpublishing.co.uk.